everyone, and welcome back to not only another day here at the Damage Report, but another week as well. A week where we're gonna do something kind of like what we did at the end of last week. We're gonna spend a bit of time with the evil stepsister dragon, Francesca Fiorentini. Francesca, welcome back to the show after such a brief break.
I know. I'm sorry. Slash, you're welcome for much me, so much fantastic things.
So much.
Many. So okay. Much. It's early.
We had you on Friday. You got 5 minutes off. Then you spent the whole day doing the Bituation Room. Yeah. Which definitely check out. And now you're back.
Yes.
We're excited for it.
Yeah, me too. It's a new week.
It's a new week, a new day. But anyway, we do have a lot of news. We're coming out of the weekend with a bunch. Biden's strong stance last week, is it worth a damn? We'll find out. AOC chimes in on a couple different things that are going on. We lose a former senator. We're gonna take a look back at his life. And then a whole bunch of stuff. The kids are socialists, and we're gonna get to a bunch of different stuff. But before we jump into all that news, I wanted to let you know about a couple things. One, over the weekend, the Bituation Room happened. It wasn't the only thing happening. You know what else happened? Jordan Yule, who streams for Deep Dive on Twitch for TYT, he held another one of his donate and drop fundraisers. In this case, it was to raise money for healthcare for the homeless. Basically, it was a marathon 2-day stream of playing Fortnite with a bunch of different people to raise money. And he raised over $25,000, which seems pretty awesome. I got to play for a couple of hours with Brett and Brooke, who I'm sure all of you are familiar with. We had a lot of fun. We hit the 25,000 mark, so supposedly Jordan is going to be getting a Fortnite themed tattoo. We don't know where yet. We have different places we're rooting for, but it is coming.
Worth a donation.
Get that tattoo.
Oh yeah.
So anyway, that was fun. And also wanted to let you know a place where perhaps, I don't know for sure, I'm not saying this is gonna happen, but maybe you can see Dr. Rashad Ritchie get a tattoo on Indisputable after this program today. No, he's not gonna do that. But what he is gonna do is have as a guest Chuck Rocha, who we've had on many times on the show. Had a lot of fun with Chuck. He's gonna come on and talk about some politics with Rashad. Charles F. Coleman is gonna be the co-host. And I believe he's co-hosting on our show tomorrow, actually. So you're gonna see a lot of him coming up soon. And conservative Major Williams, candidate in California's governor's race. They'll be having a little talk, perhaps a little debate. Should be a lot of fun. That's Indisputable coming up right after the Damage Report today. But before that, the Damage Report. So Francesca, why don't we Damage Report together?
Mm-hmm.
Let's do it. Let's do it. Last week, we found out about the bipartisan infrastructure deal, but don't worry, it's lame. We all know it's lame, but it's not all that's coming. They're gonna do all this great stuff via reconciliation. And Nancy Pelosi said, we're not doing one unless we do both. And Biden was like, I'm not signing one unless we get both. And then Republicans pretended to be like super surprised by this process. What do you mean you'll have another bill? Who do you think you are? The controlling majority in all of these branches of government. And they knew about it. They knew about it for months, but they whined and they kicked up some dust and everything. And so let's run through that and then the sort of natural consequence of that. So on Thursday, shortly after Biden triumphantly announced the Democrats and Republicans had reached an agreement on a $973 billion package, far smaller than the one he had initially promised. He said he would only sign it in tandem with his American Families Plan, a separate bill that includes spending on items Democrats have argued are also critical infrastructure, such as childcare and clean energy investments. And he said, like as if we could quote him someday, if this is the only thing that comes to me, I'm not signing it. It's in tandem. If it's the only thing that comes to me, I'm not signing it, which seems kind of clear briefly. But on Saturday, Biden walked back his remarks somewhat, saying he had not intended to issue a veto threat and that he intended to support the infrastructure plan without reservation or hesitation, saying, our bipartisan agreement, Jack, does not preclude Republicans from attempting to defeat my family's plan. Likewise, they should have no objections to my devoted efforts to pass that family's plan and other proposals in tandem. We will let the American people and the Congress decide. The bottom line is this, I gave my word to support the infrastructure plan And that's what I intend to do. I fully stand behind it without reservation or hesitation, which seems a far cry from, if this is the only thing that comes to me, I'm not signing it. Francesca, what do you think?
I mean, I think more importantly is the reaction from Republicans. We're like, yes, yes, that is right. That way we don't actually have to support the rest of this bill. That's what we wanted to hear. Like, they're all happy because they've got the president right where they want him, even though, yeah, they're in the minority. Like, we elected somehow Joe Biden out of that slate of candidates. Joe Biden's the president, okay? Mitch McConnell, Mitt Romney, Joe Manchin, not the president. All right? Yeah. Like, this is what I don't get.
We
We checked. Yeah, yeah. Sadly, like, so anyway, but yes, of course he's gonna cave. Of course he's gonna say this. Of course he's going to have a strong stance. And just when progressives are like, ooh, 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 fighting, he's like, no, I'm not gonna fight. I'm totally gonna sign it. And then, you know, they'll just issue me a little IOU of how, you know, they're gonna support the family's plan down the road. But again, we talked about this on Friday. There's a big, big lapse of months in between, you know, when potentially this bipartisan bill would get passed, if it even does, and when an infrastructure package would be included in some kind of budget reconciliation situation. I don't know what, I think they call it a situation. And it, within that time, again, how many lobbyists are gonna be coming to the feeding frenzy? How many, you know, I don't know, Dianne Feinstein is gonna lose even more of her marbles. Anything could happen.
That is true. That's the thing that could happen in particular. It's a lot of time. The thing, like, okay, it's not like last week we were like, yes, we got it. And we're gonna have the other one. We're gonna have both, like peanut butter and jelly. But like, if peanut butter is kind of like terrible, but like jelly masks it or whatever. Yes. I mean, we're a little bit worried about like somebody screwing us over in months, but right now we're good. Now is our time to shine. It like. We thought it might take a while, not like the next day. He's like, oh, that thing I said about only signing one? Who was that? I don't know that guy, Jack. Come on, that was malarkey. No, you were very clear. Except you've also been clear throughout your career, which is why we shouldn't have put much faith in it. So anyway, what I do trust in that statement he made is this. We will let the American people and the Congress decide. I mean, he doesn't mean that literally. After all, they did. They gave the American people decided. Somehow, I want Biden. Give me some Joe. And you know what? A Democratic Congress too. Let's get one of them. And then, oh wait, they're gonna need the Senate to do this? Let's do it. Wait, it has to come through Georgia? You need a Democratic? You need two Democratic senators in Georgia?
We'll give you them. Yeah.
We'll give you those. The American people decided and decided and decided. They can't decide anymore. But what he really means there is, like, you guys, these Republicans are like really being mean to me. Like, I need you to be at least as mean, or I'm gonna fold on this thing. I think that's what he's really saying.
Yeah, it is so specifically pathetic. It is so pathetic. Mm-hmm. Especially we're talking in, this is like 6 months of the presidency. In the first 6 months, to not even be able to like stand behind the idea that after all this work that you did to so-called deliver bipartisanship, look at you, you thread this needle and you can't even stand alongside your own decision to say no. Republicans, you gotta go along with the family's plan. And Democrats, you gotta go along with a crappier infrastructure plan, but we're gonna get to it later. Like, that's okay, cool. You've established your position. That's fine. It's not one I would have. It's not one I necessarily support, but it's one that he carved out for himself. And now to say, no, I'm not saying I would veto it or wouldn't sign it, right? Then that is a complete walk back of something you fought so hard to stake out. Makes no sense.
And what if that's not even true? There's additional wrinkles coming at you, America. So Biden spent the weekend backtracking on his, I will veto the bipartisan infrastructure bill if that's the only one that comes. But will he actually? We'll get to that in 1 second. At least briefly though, Republicans quite happy to hear that he's folding, even though he got the White House and they got the Senate and they got the House. Mitt Romney said, I do trust the president. And he made very clear in the much larger statement that came out over the weekend, carefully crafted and thought through piece by piece, that if the infrastructure bill reaches his desk and it comes alone, he will sign it. That's Senator Mitt Romney very much speaking like a human would. So he now has faith. Rob Portman, senator, said, we were all blindsided by the comments the previous day, which were that these two bills were connected. They've been talking about that for literally like 2 months. And I'm glad they've now been delinked. And it's very clear that we can move forward with a bipartisan bill that's broadly popular, not just among members of Congress, but the American people. So they're very happy about that. So like, I think, look, it's only fair, they should be delinked. So we took everything we didn't like out of the bipartisan bill and we've at least implied we won't filibuster it. Now it's delinked from that other one that now includes all the stuff we didn't like. Who's to say whether we'll filibuster it or not? I don't know where to put my money. So yeah, like, and Biden is fully aware of this. The Democrats are fully aware of that. Nancy Pelosi, who so far hasn't backtracked, is fully aware of this. So if they delink it, they know exactly what that means. What that means is maybe you get the bipartisan one, but you 100% put every cent you have on it. Do not get the reconciliation bill. That seems fairly clear. We will see. Especially when you don't even have all 50 Democrats in the Senate having signed on to that. We have no idea if Joe Manchin would support literally any of this. So I don't know. Francesca, like Rob Portman, Mitt Romney, are they locked down now, or is there a chance that they could end up filibustering this thing too?
Oh, I put it past no Republican to suddenly get on a higher horse to, you know, squeeze their chest together for the donors. I'm sorry, that's just where my mind's. I'm just like,
I don't even know what image you're conveying there, but I don't like it.
Okay, here's the thing. When Republicans are happy, we should be very, 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 very worried. And the other thing about Joe Manchin is, and he said, he's like, okay, yeah, budget reconciliation, but I'm not for, you know, like $4 or $5 trillion. I'm not for Bernie Sanders' plan. Well, what's your number, Joe? Like, what's your number? Maybe it's $500 billion. Maybe it's $300 billion. Maybe it doesn't even reach a trillion, right? So we don't even know with Kristen Sinema and Joe Manchin how much they would be willing to go along with. And dare I even mention the Senate budget or the Senate parliamentarian, wherever that person stands on any of this, because you know, remember, our fates are in their hands as well.
That's true. Can I piggyback on what you said about what his number is? Well, we don't know exactly. Obviously, a number only means as much as what is actually in that number. But you might recall on January 19th of this year when Senator Joe Manchin called for up to $4 trillion in infrastructure spending. And when that came out, I was like, no, there's no chance he actually means that. Because he said that, got all the headlines like, oh, Joe Biden's infrastructure plan, that's tiny, I want a bigger one. He has never reiterated that since then. So we'll see. Now all of a sudden, a couple $1 trillion is too much. Like, we don't know what his final number is gonna be. But like I said, there's a little bit of nuance here, and that is this. On CNN's State of the Union, White House advisor Cedric Richmond repeatedly avoided directly answering whether Biden would sign the bipartisan infrastructure bill if it landed on his desk alone, saying, quote, I don't think it's a yes or no question. Well, no, it definitely is a yes or no question. You clearly don't want to answer it, whether because you're worried about scaring the left or you're worried about scaring people like Rob Portman and Mitt Romney. But it definitely is a yes or no question. Are they linked? Are they delinked? Those are two very different situations there. He was super clear that they were linked. Now he's trying to make it seem pretty clear that they're not linked. But now you're saying, who's to say, you know, words are social constructs. Are they linked or not? I feel like if we're gonna wait the next 3 months before a final vote, we should at least have some idea of what's gonna happen during that time. But Francesca, I'm gonna throw one more thing out there. And that is that they're obviously worried about Republicans not supporting this, the 10 Republicans that they need. But bear in mind, there are some Democrats that are not happy with the way this is going. Bernie Sanders reiterated yesterday, I believe this was, yes, saying, let me be clear, there will not be a bipartisan infrastructure deal without a reconciliation bill that substantially improves the lives of working families and combats the existential threat of climate change. No reconciliation bill, no deal. We need transformative change now. So he's trying to be pretty clear there too. I, you know, am inclined to trust him more. We'll see what happens over the next 3 months. But you know, Rob Portman deciding he's not going to vote for this is not the only thing that Biden needs to worry about. Any final thoughts?
I mean, that sort of seems to me like it hints that maybe there is a progressive bloc. And I know that the Congressional Progressive Caucus has been, you know, very vocal about this and making sure that there is a budget reconciliation deal along with the infrastructure bill, but maybe that they'll withhold their votes. And I would say that if Republicans are threatening to withhold their votes, and the Joe Manchins and the Kristen Sinemas who are standing next to the president with this infrastructure bill just beaming like, oh look, he chose us, oh my God, even though we're the worst people. Then progressives should as well, you know, then because I'm not convinced, and I hate to say this, I think that if none of this passes, it would be bad. I don't think it would mean that all of this is dead, if that makes sense. It would be, I'm not gonna, again, I think that some deal is better than absolutely nothing, but I also don't feel like none of this stuff could get passed ever again. Like this is our only chance, which is how everyone sort of makes it seem, especially those who have the most to stand to gain. And I don't mean the American people, I mean politicians and their donors.
Yeah. We'll see. Yeah, I agree. I'm not expecting everything, but I am saying that the bipartisan bill is very much not everything. So hopefully Bernie is right. Hopefully Bernie has others that are willing to back him up. I don't know if anyone else is in that block. I suspect that they're not, but who knows? I haven't seen Elizabeth Warren or Merkley or a few others. We'll see what they think. In any event, we do have to take our first break, but when we come back, we're gonna talk a little bit more about some of the politics of this, including on the filibuster after this. Anyway, we got a lot more news to get to, Francesca. You ready for this? Okay, let's do it. Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez was on with Chuck Todd, because that's a thing you apparently have to do. And she was asked about Kyrsten Sinema's argument against the filibuster, that it's important to have it, because if you don't have it, then sure, you'll pass legislation. But then the other party will just come into power and they'll reverse it, and then you'll reverse their reversal, and so on and so on. Is that a reason to get rid of the filibuster, or to keep the filibuster, I should say? Here's what AOC had to say.
It's essentially an argument of saying, well, why do anything at all in case something in the future may change it? Political systems all across the country, I mean, all across the world, pass legislation with majorities and they're fine. And frankly, here's the thing, is that Democratic legislation, once enacted, is popular. Republicans have tried to gut Social Security. They've tried to reverse the ACA. They've tried to claw back on legislation that has passed by simple majorities in the Senate. And they haven't been able to because Democratic policies are popular. And once they are enacted, they are very politically difficult to undo. And so, you know, I do not believe in the defeatism of saying we will lose in the future and that, and this will automatically mean that anything we do now is going to be reversed. So we might as well not do anything now. Our job is to legislate. Our job is to help people. Our job is to do as much as we can. And even if that's the case, even if that is the case, wouldn't it be better to get people healthcare and voting rights for 3 years instead of 0 years, even if you concede the point that I don't even think is true in the first place.
Okay, AOC is making some great points there. They would occasionally cut to a wide shot and you'd see Chuck Todd just desperately trying to get in to derail it with some BS, but she persevered and got in some good points, Francesca. What do you think about that? Was there anything to Sinema's argument?
No, and I think this is an argument that not just, I mean, well, somehow Sinema's already a Republican in my mind. Maybe I'm like foreshadowing for what she will become. But it is very much a centrist line, and you hear it parroted in the media all the time. You know, sort of this warning about the filibuster that, oh no, but if we change the filibuster, it's gonna come back to bite us in the end. And it's like, so we'll have enshrined voting rights, and we will have lowered the age of Medicare to 60. Like, people will not die. There's a lot of things that can happen between now and whenever you're worried that like the Senate is going to change again, right? Or whenever you're worried that like Biden won't be reelected or whatever it is. Like, she's absolutely 100% right in both accounts, right? And she goes on to say essentially that the filibuster, that there's already a filibuster in the Senate because of how undemocratic and how unrepresentative the Senate is by its very nature. We've talked about this before. Yes. And I've even floated the idea, like you should just skew, like if you're gonna keep the filibuster, then skew the Senate so there's more Democrats, since they literally represent however millions of more people. Something like tens of millions more people, right? So I'm glad that she's pointing out the structurally undemocratic things of this country. Last thing on Sinema has said in the same breath that she defends the filibuster, she says, you know, the Senate is not the most functional place in the country. I think we all agree, you know, it's got some hangups. It's like, but we need to support the filibuster. Like, what are you saying?
That's the hangup.
The Senate is literally, yes, dysfunctional because of the filibuster. So we further enshrine it? No, you're insane. You're just saying word salad over and over again so you can appeal to whomever, whatever dark money groups are backing you in your next election bid.
Yeah, 100%. And of course, like, I think AOC could have mentioned this. I'm not surprised that she didn't. Everything that Sinema said there, BS, not just BS because it's wrong, as AOC pointed out, BS in that she doesn't care about it. Like, she's making arguments that she does not care about, which is sort of like the trendy thing in politics and in media these days. Just say the stuff that you're supposed to say to continue to have the people who fund you like you. You don't have to mean any of it. You don't, and that makes so much of what we want to try to do pointless, because we want to rebut, we want to argue, we want to try to persuade, but you can't do that if they're not making arguments that they actually care about. You can't change someone's mind if it's not reflective of their actual mind. She doesn't care about this. She's just not interested in the government actually accomplishing anything. Mm-hmm. But if she were to be honest, then she would know that this is a recipe for sort of exactly what AOC was pointing out, not accomplishing anything. The Republicans are not waiting for a more bipartisan bill. They don't care to do anything.
Yeah.
And so you would just not do anything. And think about that. Like, imagine, why is she not 1% as scared of spending the next couple of years accomplishing literally nothing as she is of accomplishing something and then having the Republicans reverse it? Because I personally think, if you are worried about Republicans getting in office, doing literally nothing is a weird way to ward that off. Yep. What you could do is pass popular legislation, which this is, make the Republicans stand against it, probably not successfully without a filibuster, but make them make the case. If the American people do agree with the Republicans, then they'll vote them in. After the Democrats do a bunch of popular stuff, then somehow the Republicans get back in office, and then make the Republicans do unpopular stuff to reverse it.
Yes.
Actually have this debate, because the behind closed doors fake bipartisan debate, people don't know about that. All they know is the promises that were made by politicians.
Yes.
And Biden is at least ostensibly trying to make good on those promises. Actually do that. That's how a government is supposed to function. She's just avoiding, like, just let's just not do anything for literally years. Let's just not do a single thing. Now, that said, really fast, I want to throw a little bit more of AOC, because she has a second point, and then I want to give you a chance to jump in. Here's AOC's point about why not just go further with what Sinema is saying.
Beyond that, then the argument is, okay, why 60 votes?
Right.
Why not stop at 70 votes? Why not need 80 votes to pass any legislation. Why defend a 60-vote filibuster when the Senate already amplifies minority power so that the 50 Democratic senators already represent millions and millions and millions more Americans than 50 Republican senators? And so I would argue that 50 Republican senators is already a built-in kind of filibuster-esque firewall.
Yeah, it is already. And why 60? Literally, why 60? Rather than 61 or 59? It's not in the Constitution. It's not even the number that it's always been. It's certainly not the number now for things like, you know, bills that can get through via reconciliation or nominating and confirming judges.
Yep.
So you can change it. They have changed it. Why are you so wedded specifically to 60? Why does that produce more bipartisanship than 65 or 55 or 51 or whatever? Mm-hmm. But again, it's a good point. It's logical. It makes sense. And it's completely beside the point and irrelevant because Sinema doesn't believe literally any of this.
Yeah. And I think, you know, look, I am not someone who believes that Democrats are paid to lose and blah, 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 blah. But when you look at Kristen Sinema, man, that argument makes sense. Because if you think about it, what's it to her if Trump gets reelected? What's it to her if Tucker Carlson becomes president? She's gonna fundraise even more. Why?
Probably.
Because she's not a fascist. Oh, hey, put, you know, vote for me again because, you know, I believe in LGBTQ rights and I believe that, you know, in like minimal criminal justice reform, or I believe, I don't know, that gravity exists. Like the basic things. And she can raise tons of money if you've got a fascist Republican in office. But when there's a Democrat, ooh, and you actually have to do stuff, ugh, like enshrining voting rights or like, ooh, helping people get healthcare, ooh, then all my like pharma donors, ooh, climate change, oh gosh, my fossil fuel donors, oh no, Amazon, oh, you wanna rein in big tech? See, Amazon's a big donor because I'm in Arizona. That's where they funnel all their money through. Ah, not gonna do that. Oh, but a Republican comes into office? Yes. Amazon's gonna give me so much money because of that.
Yeah, yeah, and I understand like everything that Francesca's saying there, I think is 100% right. And it is true of far too many politicians, especially on the Democratic side. Don't fall into the easy, cheap, shallow like apathy of, and thus it must be true of literally every politician, which is very much not.
No, because you see,
like
I'm sorry.
To that, a purity to that.
No. You see AOC just being not that politician, right? She's called out Manchin directly. Now she's asked to reply to Sinema and she's like, no, you know what? I'm gonna say it. So no, this is not about all Democrats at all, especially now that I think we've got an upstart of really wonderful Democrats, but it definitely is true of some of these centrists and moderates.
Let's switch it up. This is just fun for me. Sorry, I apologize. It's fun for me. And at least until they pull me off this chair, I get to put stuff on the rundown. So during the weekend's Donald Trump speech, Donald Trump said stuff, but I don't know what it is and we're not gonna show it to you. That said, there was something that I saw going around and it was this really cheap, weird attack from Marjorie Greene against Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Here's what she had to say.
Led by AOC, the little communist from New York City.
That's right. Yeah, lock her up too. That's a good idea.
She's not an American. She really doesn't embrace our American ways. You want to know why? She has something called the Green New Deal.
Ugh. Anyway, there was a lot there that we will respond to, but I want to give you Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's response, which was thankfully brief. I think it's okay to respond. I don't think that she should dwell too much on it, but we'll talk more about that. She said, first of all, I'm taller than her. I just love that so much. Like, oh, after all the ridiculous, the little communist from New York City, like it's just, it's so weird. And like, she's trying to do the Trump thing of the little, but anyway, it was fact checked. AOC is apparently 5'4", Green is 5'3". So they're both shorties or whatever, but AOC is a little bit taller. So
no, that's my favorite part is them. They are both short and it's very cute to have them being like, an inch matters, damn it. I saw you wearing heels, girl. I saw you. Like, that's very funny. And then, of course, Marjorie Taylor Greene responds, like, you're still a communist. Because she admits it. Like, Marjorie, you could just lie. You could just be like, no, I'm also 5'4". Whatever. You know what I mean? Like, but she instead was like, okay, fine, but you're still communist.
No, but I love the limits to her willingness to deceive. So she'll wear like a mask that says Trump won, but height, some things are still sacred. Yeah. She's not gonna lie about that. Well, but the issue is that we at some point, well, hopefully not, but we might see them standing next to each other. So it doesn't actually work. But I love that AOC only responded to that one portion of it, because she's a little, like, the thing about Marjorie Greene is I want better foes. Like, just going up on there and saying, yes, oh, that little communist from New York City, it's just so cheap. It's so entry level. It's so, like, there's no nuance. There's no stagecraft. There's just nothing to it. She's a little communist. It's what, I guess in some ways, maybe it's better that this is what Republicans have been saying about Democrats for years and years. At least Green didn't say that she's, you know, tearing kids' faces off in a basement and drinking their adrenochrome or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. I guess it's better in that way. What I don't like, though, is the when she pivots to the she isn't really an American. Why is that? I think we know. I think we know about what AOC is. It is that makes her not an American there. But anyway, I want to briefly turn to this. And the question is, we decided that we would cover very briefly the attack against AOC from Marjorie Greene and her response, and acknowledging that she did respond. Now, responding can come in a lot of different forms. In this case, she just made fun of the fact that she's actually taller than Marjorie Greene. Marjorie Greene wants her to actually debate her on what, who knows? I don't think Marjorie Greene even knows, but she certainly wants to stand next to AOC when the cameras are rolling. The question is, what is the proper strategy here? Should AOC just let Marjorie Greene attack her and attack her and attack her? She's previously said that she wants to stand up to her just to show that she's not going to let a racist white politician try to demonize through vitriol women of color in politics. I wanted to read just two short excerpts from Elie Mistal's recent article in The Nation, because he gets into this, and I sort of agree with his take on it. And Fran, I want to see what you think about it. He said, mm-hmm. Wrestling, he acknowledged that it was fine for her to tweet, which she did. But then he says, wrestling with Green does Ocasio-Cortez no good, since it only elevates Green, even if Ocasio-Cortez is only lifting her up to throw her in the trash. Secondly, Green has no policy platform to debate. While Ocasio-Cortez has an actual agenda to defend, the Green New Deal, Medicare for All, and many other positions, Green is a conspiracy theory made flesh who is only able to string together two sentences in support of guns, chin-ups, and racism. You can't debate that. You can only wipe it off your shoes. MTG is not the right-wing version of AOC, despite her own best efforts to set herself up as AOC's nemesis. She does not have a coherent policy agenda like AOC does. She hasn't brought new voters into the political process like AOC has. And she's not as influential within her own party as AOC has become. The only things MTG is good at are being white and a jerk. What do you think? What should AOC have even done what she did with the tweet? Should she go further? What should she do? What shouldn't she?
I think the tweet was good and warranted. Here's my thing about debating or not debating. Obviously, AOC would wipe the floor 10 times over with Marjorie Taylor Greene, and it would be a good platform potentially to really talk about what a Green New Deal is to supporters who might like Marjorie Taylor Greene and have their minds change, maybe one or two. But we know that's not what would happen, right? What would happen is the right would cut up their, you know, version of the debate. It would be like Marjorie Taylor Greene slays, destroys, blah, and it would just be edited by, you know, Andy, whatever the hell that dude's name is. I'm gonna call it no. It would be edited and it would be like completely chewed up and spit out by the spin machine. And so there's that. The real thing for me, though, is that the way that Marjorie Taylor Greene has been going about trying to get AOC to debate her is a classic right-wing troll tactic. We've seen it online all of the time, right? It is, debate me on my show, debate me, give me the clicks, debate me. That's all it is. That's what the right knows how to do. And not only that, debate me or you're a shill. Debate me or you're terrible. We might also be talking about some lefties. Debate me or And that is fundamentally disrespectful. If she hadn't been stalking her in Congress, following her around, like approaching her after meetings and like yelling in her face, I would say, yeah, maybe. If it was like a formal letter, if it was like, hey, let's have a town hall, if there was something like anything formal about it. But it's not. It's been trash talking and it's been baiting. And I don't think you validate that with a debate.
Yeah. 100%. And the thing is, like, I think that most of these debates are absolutely pointless. But I do differentiate that there are some people who are doing something that I consider largely pointless for reasons that I think are admirable. They want to convince people. And I acknowledge that there are some people, a very narrow swath, who can be persuaded. I just think it's nothing like what we think of when we think of debate. But then there are the others that know that. Like for instance, you're talking about right-wing media and sometimes not just right-wing media. Actually doing a show where you talk about what's really going on is both more work and not necessarily as sexy as I'm in a feud. And that's why they wanna do it largely. That's why Marjorie Greene wants to do it. And that's not like AOC doesn't need that and doesn't want that. So I think so far she has done it the right way. She'll respond briefly to the attacks. She doesn't elevate her, she doesn't delve into the substance of the attacks as if it's there, I guess, whether she's a communist or not. I think that that's probably a good road to go down.
Yeah.
But that said, you know, this debate stuff is popular. So I have a compromise. I think that AOC should agree to debate her, and then Marjorie Greene walks out, and then it's Sam Sanders. Sam Sanders walks out. It's not AOC. Now that I could watch. Oh, it's Sam Sanders.
Oh, what an epic nightmare.
And by the way, a great, I think, just example of what you're talking about there, about the cutting up or whatever. Like, Crowder did run. He ran. And how many of his people did it convince that he's fake, that he's a coward, that he doesn't actually mean any of the debate stuff? I'm sure that there's a couple anecdotally, but he ran in as embarrassing a fashion as I've literally ever seen in one of these debates. And I don't know how many people that's actually convinced. It's gotten lefties fired up. I like the memes, they're funny, and the songs and all that. Like, it's good for us. That's the sort of tribal thing that it does. But in terms of actually persuading people, has it? I hope so, but I don't know that I necessarily believe it has. Mm-mm. Let's get into this. Marjorie Greene would have you believe that she's the same as AOC. They have a platform, but do they really? I'll show you what they have, because she showed us when she went on Steve Bannon's podcast. So she accused Democrats of trying to separate America by identity group, whether it's transgenders, blacks, Hispanics, after Steve Bannon asked her about the war on women. This is what she had to say. They want everybody to be a victim, and then they need them to be dependent on the Democrats and their policies and their plans and goals in order to be able to survive. Now we have the Democrat Party that claims to be the champion for women. They claim that abortion is pregnancy rights, but instead that's killing a baby in a woman's womb. It's actually the worst scar a woman can carry for the rest of her life. Their war on women has gone beyond anything we can possibly understand. They are putting men. These are men, and I say they are playing dress up, and I'm not trying to offend anyone, but they are literally having an identity crisis. They are dressing up like women, and then they want to be recognized as a woman, which they are not. They never will be, and I refuse to recognize them that way. So that's just dumb person transphobia. That's all it is. And it's like the you're a little communist thing. So like you're the next big thing for the right. Obviously, you're going to be against reproductive rights. You're going to give the best argument against it. Their best argument is they claim that abortion is pregnancy rights, but instead that's killing a baby in a woman's womb.
You do a really good, like, I don't even want to attempt my Marjorie, because yours is actually really good because it's lower pitched. It is kind of like sharper edges like that, you know, and it's good. It's really good.
I don't want it to be too good, but thank you. But that said, that's not even a nuanced version of the pro-life argument. They say it's one thing, but I say it's this. Okay, cool, I guess. And then they say they're women. I say they're men. Good. Good, let's have a clash of ideologies here for the fate of the civil rights of a group of millions of people. I won't say they're women. Okay, I'm just saying, like, again.
Why come?
Better foes.
Why come you can't sneeze with your eyes closed, huh? You say that's science. I say that's cute. You know, like that's, oh. This is, but see, here's what I will say. As much as I hate Donald Trump, Marjorie Taylor Greene makes you appreciate that he was a man of few words. Sure, he said them a lot, but his word cloud was very small. So he didn't actually explicitly be like, you know, men are dressing like women. That's wrong. He's just saying, you know, something strange, it's a little weird. Anyway, we've got to protect women. Like, he's just very vague. And the vagary, it comes from the same idiocy, but like Marjorie Greene, her idiocy manifests itself as just like saying the thing, you know, six beers in on a porch in, I don't know, the whitest part of South Carolina. Like, that is where, that's her. Her id is very dumb, and it's not projected in any kind of vagary or grandiosity or even like bombast that Trump's is. And it makes it, it just makes it all the more like bald face and open.
Yeah, and the reason I point this out is I don't get why it worked. Like, they've had better a-holes than this before. Like, this is an a-hole, but it's not even like a good one.
No.
Like a clever one. Like, if, I don't know, if Trump is, this is gonna be the weirdest comparison ever. If Trump is like the Get Out of a-holes, this is the Karen. Like, this is that like, it goes viral and you're like, I get what you're going for, but I don't think this is really right. It seems a bit over, like it's beating you over the head with it. I just don't get why it would still work in that
you're
way.
You're talking about the
Trump
movie.
Is basically Jordan Peele. Yes.
Yeah, but anyway, it is interesting. No, just that it is nice to see someone like this making their, like, truly. Look, this is what Republicans have been saying all the time. They just dress it up in Ivy League language, okay? So the fact that Marjorie Taylor Greene is just openly being a bigot and a homophobe and a racist is like, yeah, because that's what your party has sowed over the last 50 years. This is what you've essentially been saying. Nixon was saying this in private. Yeah, Marjorie Taylor Greene is your product, right? So don't dress it up in your, you know, again, your Harvard degree, because, or your law degree, it doesn't matter. This is still what it is. You want to take healthcare away from poor people. You want to make it easier to incarcerate people of color. You're as racist. You just know how to enshroud it in BS better.
I agree. That just three towns: being white, being a jerk. Yeah, lack of the shrouding though. Anyway, we're going to take a break. When we come back, a former senator has passed away. We're going to talk about Mike Gravel's legacy after this. Okay, ooh, this hour is running out fast. So let's jump right into this. Former senator and presidential candidate Mike Gravel passed away over the weekend. We just wanted to briefly talk a little bit about his legacy, some of the things that he did. I mean, he's largely known for like reading literally thousands of pages of the Pentagon Papers into the congressional record, which would, like, that sort of thing would be huge now. Doing that 50 years ago or so, even bigger. So that's pretty amazing. He had this to say near the end: I'm the fellow that ended the draft. I'm the one that stopped the nuclear testing in the North Pacific. I'm the one that brought about the Alaska pipeline. I'm the one that released the Pentagon Papers and had to go to the Supreme Court because Richard Nixon was trying to throw me in jail. That's what I did 28, 29, 30 years ago. That was leadership then. And I was excoriated by the media at that point. I was a loose cannon. Well, right today, I've had the good fortune to live this long. And people look back and say, my God, were you a courageous leader? Well, that's the leadership you'll get when I become president of the United States. Now, can the American people stand that kind of leadership? That remains to be seen. So obviously that didn't happen, of course. And he's certainly a bold one anyway. I want to just give a couple of these quotes that we had culled for this. So on the Pentagon paper says, people, human beings are being killed as I speak to you tonight. Killed as a direct result of policy decisions that we as a body have made. Arms are being severed. Metal is crashing through human bodies because of a public policy. This government, at that point he began to sob. One may respond that we have made such a sacrifice to preserve freedom and liberty in Southeast Asia. One may respond that we sacrifice ourselves on the continent of Asia so that we will not have to fight a similar war on the shores of America. One can make these arguments only if he has failed to read the Pentagon Papers. That is the terrible truth of it all. And then of course goes on to read so much of it into the congressional record so that it can't be denied and all that. So we have more, Francesca, but what are your thoughts?
Well, first of all, that the reading of the Pentagon Papers barely happened, and Mike Gravel and Daniel Ellsberg worked together to make sure that he got a copy. It was like, I can't remember the specifics of it, but it barely happened, but it was so powerful to enter this like devastating information, which was essentially that one, the war had expanded, right? It expanded to Cambodia and Laos, not just Vietnam, but that also it was not going well. They were losing. The United States was losing, and yet we were still there. I believe that was some part of the revelation, and Congress wouldn't have heard about it. You know, they would have seen it in the news, sure, but this entered in public record. The American people throughout history will know and can look back at that moment when he took that stand and when he read that in public. So again, these heroic acts that make you sort of the loose cannon, make you the weirdo, makes Bernie Sanders the, oh, you were an independent. Yeah, he was an independent. That allowed him to rise above some of your partisan BS and actually, you know, stand for something.
Yeah. And you know, like how much longer would it have taken? How many more lives would have been lost? Like these are obviously incredibly important questions. And it's not to say that like any politician, especially a politician who's been in the public figure for literally decades, the public eye for literally decades, not to say that we agree with everything they did, clearly. But we can admire, especially stances like this that are so consequential when it comes to war and American imperialism and all that. Now that said, I want to take you back to the 2008 presidential campaign and a debate where he did some calling out of other candidates. I think we have time for this. Let's go to that video.
These people frighten me. They frighten me. When you have mainline candidates that turn around and say that there's nothing off the table with respect to Iran, that's code for using nukes, nuclear devices. I gotta tell you, I'm president of the United States. There will be no preemptive wars with nuclear devices. To my mind, it's immoral, and it's been immoral for the last 50 years as part of American foreign policy.
Let's use a little moderator discretion here. Senator Gravel, that's a weighty charge. Who on this stage exactly tonight worries you so much?
Well, I would say the top tier ones. They've made statements. Oh, Joe, I'll include you too. You have a certain arrogance. You want to tell the Iraqis how to run their country. I got to tell you, we should just play get out. Just play get out. It's their country. They're asking us to leave, and we insist on staying there. And why not get out? What harm is it going to do? You hear the statement, well, my God, the soldiers will have died in vain. The entire deaths of Vietnam died in vain. And they're dying in vain right this very second. You know what's worse than a soldier dying in vain? Is more soldiers dying in vain. That's what's worse.
I mean, that's one of the best things I've ever seen on the debate stage, I think, right there. Okay, we don't have much more time, unfortunately, but Francesca, any other thoughts?
No, I mean, that's super heroic. And I think it's really funny that he's calling out Biden, Obama and Hillary, who all wanted to continue the war, except for Obama, right? That's how he was distinguished. And I would argue with his longer conversation, that is what distinguished him from Clinton, was that Obama really did want to get out of Iraq and then did. And Hillary Clinton was not so sure, et cetera, et cetera. But yeah, good on him. Good on him. Yeah. And what a great way to point out the most ridiculous argument for staying in a war, which is, well, then all these other, the people who died, you know, would have died for nothing. It's like, so we got to kill more people. Makes no
exactly.
sense.
Exactly. It's the sunk cost fallacy, but for something not important. It's not money. We're only talking about lives, basically. Yeah, you're 100% right.
Yeah.
I love that he called out Biden. And look at the moderator protecting him there, trying to like get him to back down. Isn't that weird? Anyway, thank you, our linear audience. The show goes on online, though. We got more news for you after this.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.